Welcome to Bridging the Bones, a podcast exploring the causes, context, and potential solutions to conflict. I'm your host, Sotaline Wang.
And they were preaching against war, and they were making sermons against it, and traveling. And the two of them got arrested in Caton for pouring blood on draft files and destroying government property. And
Blood? Like their own blood?
Yeah, well, back this is before AIDS.
Our guest today is Jesse Clark, who is releasing segments of their memoir titled A Life in Stories by Jesse Clark in podcast form this September 2025 at the website radioreimagined.com. Jesse has involved themselves in social movements for much of their life, picketing housing discrimination as a child in Washington, D.C., becoming a student protester against the Vietnam War, an organizer within the Central American Anti-Imperialist Solidarity Movement, and with the anti-apartheid actions against the South African government in the 1980s. Today, we are discussing what influence growing up Irish Catholic has had on their life and outlook, starting with John F. Kennedy, the first Catholic president of the United States. Please be aware that some words and themes from this discussion are not suitable for all audiences.
Did you remember the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
No. I mean, yes, I did, but it wasn't until I was just 7, 8 years old then. But when Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were assassinated, I was already a budding activist. And in fact, I was watching television in the basement of my house when they broke into the news with an alert that Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot.
Oh, this was 1968.
April 4th. And I ran upstairs and told my father, and he was pretty upset. And he immediately knew that there was going to be riots. There had been big riots in the summer of 1967 in Detroit and other cities, and Watts 65. So the racist tensions in the United States were really at a boiling point. And when King, who was leading advocate of nonviolence, was murdered by what most people assume was the government, people started rioting. And my father knew that was going to happen. And he said, "Oh shit!" And then within an hour or two, we heard sirens, and the evening came on. We could smell the smoke of the riots downtown. I mean, a lot of people got killed in those riots. People don't realize there was quite a death count. In the police shot a lot of people during the riots all across the country,
including in D.C. is what you're saying.
Yeah, they killed people. In fact, in D.C., not only did they bring out the National Guard, Lyndon Johnson also mobilized the U.S. Army. And so he had National Guard troops and Army troops occupy the city. And it took them three days or more to put down the riot.
Including your junior high.
Well, they sent the troops. I suppose they sent the troops to the white neighborhoods, theoretically, to protect us, or at least to protect the white stores, but they occupied the whole city. So as a result of that, a lot of the kids in school had already been active, got even more activated, and we're pretty unhappy to see. We were already anti-war against the Vietnam War. So
what was your parents' reason for being against the Vietnam War?
They both had leftist political sympathies, and they saw the Irish resistance to the British as a paradigm for, you know, self-determination in their younger days. And then in the 60s, they got won over to pacifism. My father was in the Marines, so he wasn't a pacifist in his younger days, but he was won over to the ideology of pacifism, if not its actual practice. And so the war was obviously wrong, and it was not a just war. In Catholic doctrine, you can have a just war, but it was an unjust war. And a lot of Catholics were against it, and King was leading the civil rights movement. But you might recall that 1 year to the day before he got assassinated, he gave a speech in New York where he brought together the topics of civil rights and made a very vigorous denunciation of U.S. imperialism and the war in Vietnam and the right of third world peoples, as they were called, to self-determination. And he suggested that even armed revolution is sometimes necessary, even though he also was a very strict pacifist. But Berrigan's, I don't know, that's another little obscurity of Catholic history, but there's two priests that were called the Berrigan brothers, Phil and Dan, and they were preaching against the war, and they were making sermons against it, and they were traveling, and the two of them got arrested in Catonsville for pouring blood on draft files and destroying government property. And
Wait, blood? Like their own blood?
yeah, well, back
Where
then
did they
there was
get this
no,
blood from?
this is before AIDS. They took their own blood and they put it in little vials, and they broke into the draft office and poured blood on the files, and they also dragged the file cabinet out into the street and set it on fire. And they didn't always have backup copies of the draft records, and in one of the Catholic groups, they succeeded in breaking into the office and destroying all the files, and they actually got away with it because not all of them wanted to get arrested and do civil disobedience. Some of them wanted to actually disrupt the draft. So my parents took us to Catonsville for a supportive rally that they had, because I think there was some 27 people that were prosecuted for that. And I mean, no, it was 27 arrested, but nine of them were prosecuted. The Catonsville Nine, I think they were called. Anyway, so we went up there. We slept on the floor in the church and the parochial school, and then we marched. So,
Wait, remind our audience where Catonsville is.
oh, it's a far. I think it's close to the Pennsylvania border, so it's quite a ways away from Washington, D.C. So it was not it's more than a day trip.
Let's back up a bit first. So you were born in 1956, right? Eastern Seaboard, more or less.
Yeah, I grew up on the East Coast.
Of the United States. But you mostly grew up around Washington, D.C.
Yeah, until I was a young adult.
And when did your family move to Washington?
Around 1960, or early, maybe right before or after Kennedy got elected.
And why did your family move to Washington, D.C. at that time?
Well, I believe that my father got a job at a civil rights organization. I think, I don't recall exactly because I was a kid. I think it was called the Religion and Labor Council, something to that effect. He worked with religious, the Catholic Church, primarily connecting civil rights and labor rights, and doing education around that.
Wasn't there some controversy about John F. Kennedy being Catholic
Well, it
before he
was
was
the first
elected?
Catholic. Yeah. The accusation was that since he was a practicing Catholic and the Pope is the authority in the Catholic Church, that he would in some way be taking orders from the Vatican, and that Catholics were not to be trusted. And the Protestant Reformation and the people who called the Catholic Church evil, when they founded Lutheranism, when Luther on the
Martin
church
Luther.
door. Yeah. So, Protestants often thought less of Catholics. And in the United States, Irish and Italian Catholics were later immigrants and, heavily discriminated against. And it was surprising that the United States elected a Catholic, when by the time Biden ran for president, it wasn't really that noticeable that he was Catholic.
What's one of your earliest memories that is sharp in your mind when you think about growing up as an Irish Catholic?
Well, we went to church every week, and the first rite, you get baptized when you're an infant, so you don't experience or remember that, but you go to your first confession, usually when you're in your first first year of elementary school, or maybe a little later than that. And in order to get, and in my case, I did not go to Catholic school, but I went to something called CCD, which was Saturday school, which was they taught you the principles of Catholic religion on Saturdays, and then you went to church on Sundays. So it's what Protestants call Sunday school, but Catholics call it Saturday school, but it was actually called catechism. And in that, they have you memorize all the principal tenets of the Catholic Church, and then you have to recite them to the nuns. And then to receive communion, you have to make a good confession. And a confession is a place where the priest is empowered to forgive your sins on behalf of God. And when your sins are forgiven, you're eligible to go to heaven. So, my first clear memory was going of Catholicism was going to catechism class, and they had the books were better than the books they gave us in kindergarten and first grade, because they had actually texts and stories, and so it was like a dumbed down version of the Bible stories, like with pictures and stuff.
And was this in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, that was at the church was called the Shrine of the Blessed Sacrament. Historical side note, Brett Kavanaugh is currently a member of that parish.
So your family used to go to the same church that Brett Kavanaugh is currently going to.
That's exactly true. And when I heard
That's
that,
a strange coincidence.
I when I heard, well, there's that, like I said, in the 60s, Washington, D.C. was still completely segregated. And the part of Washington that all the whites lived in was in Northwest, and it's pretty small geographical space. And a lot of the cabinet secretaries and Supreme Court judges, lived in the neighborhood where we lived, even though my father was a pretty poor working class person. So yeah, that's where Supreme Court judges go to church.
I believe you were recording regarding your mother and how she named you.
Yeah, actually, I could read that. So the first rite that you do when you're a Catholic kid is first communion, and to get first communion, you have to have confession, and then the second big rite for a Catholic kid is confirmation, and confirmation is something. It's a Catholic thing. It's like a bar mitzvah would be for Jewish people. You're supposed to be coming of age, and you choose to join the church in a conscious way, and when you do, the bishop comes to your parish and gives you a new name, and you have to pick a name that is a saint's name. I'm 11 years old. I'm in sixth grade. I'm growing up in Washington, D.C. Now, I'm coming into the church from side entrance off the parking lot by the little library where I've been reading up on saints' biographies so I can pick a good one to be named after. I can hear my catechism teacher, Sister Thomas, around the corner, lining the kids up with her little frog clicker. I want to make a good confession, but I can never remember my sins. Back in first grade, before first communion, we had to do our first confession, and Sister Thomas coached us on what sort of sins we should tell. I lied to my parents. I fought with my brother and sister. I ate meat on Friday, and so when I got to confession, I didn't have any sins, so I made up some sins. That was actually my first real sin, lie in confession. Ever since, I've always tried to have good sins for the priest. Now, back when I was six, I already had a haunting sense that big sins were going on around me. I just could never figure out whose sins they really were. And even though I confessed to it, the truth is I never ate meat on Friday. My mom always made fish sticks because she was super devout. In fact, she named me after her favorite saint, Saint Benedict Joseph Labre. He was a French saint, not the Benedictines. This was a kind of obscure saint. She told me he never ate meat at all, except a little bit of lamb on Easter. And according to her, Saint Benedict was the first hobo saint. He never worked, just to bum around Europe and ask people for food in a crack bowl. Vegetarian food, I guess. And he died homeless, sick, and penniless on the streets of Rome. And this is a good thing, though, because he did it on purpose for God. And that was my mom's idea of a really good saint. Saint Benedict, that's who she wanted me to grow up to become. But I can't wait to get a new name. My sisters call me Ben the Dick. My brother Mark calls me BJ. It comes with the little chant. Once for a nickel, twice for a dime. BJ will blow you anytime. Now, I don't know exactly what a blowjob is, but I know it's about sex and it's gross and faggy. And of course, at school, everyone teases me about Benedict Arnold, the traitor. But get this, Sister Thomas used to be named Agnes. When a nun is consecrated to Jesus, she gets a new name, even boy names. Now, I wouldn't want to be named Agnes, but Benedict is worse. I'll tell you, Saint Joan of Arc is my favorite saint. She dressed up as a soldier and fought and beat the English. My grandfather likes her too. We Irish hate the English more than anyone. While a lot of people think Joan of Arc was burned at the stake because of witchcraft or heresy, the charge that she was finally executed for was dressing like a male soldier. She wouldn't repent of it or stop doing it, even in prison. And the judge said to her, "For whoever doth such things is abhorrent to the Lord our God." So, I guess since they burned Joan of Arc at the stake, dressing as the opposite sex was a sin. But then they made her a saint later. So maybe dressing up really isn't a sin. Our confirmation gown looks like a women's dress. And so, for that matter, does the priest's robe. So I'm thinking maybe I could get a girl saint name, just like Sister Thomas got a boy one. Like Bridget, my grandpa's favorite saint is Bridget. He says she's the patron saint of beer, and he toasts, he'll say, "To Saint Bridget, who can turn water into beer."
You just heard a studio recording of Jesse Clark performing an excerpt from their memoir, A Life in Stories, from a segment titled A Good Sin. We will return after a word from our sponsor. This is Bridging the Bones, a podcast exploring the causes, context, and possible solutions to conflict. Welcome back to part one of our interview with Jesse Clark. Your parents, they dropped out of the Catholic Church or dropped out of church,
what happened was
church attendance?
The Vatican II was in the early 60s. Began allowing or requiring that the mass be spoken in the vernacular of the country, so in English in the United States or Spanish, and not in Latin, and demystifying a lot of the, and relaxing a lot of the church rules, so that this sort of upsurge of activism had filtered into some of the institutional levels. But Blessed Sacrament, as I mentioned, is a very conservative parish, and my parents felt more and more stifled there. So they joined with the Berrigans and some other people that started a underground masses, which were openly rebellious and supported women's ordination and were against the war. And they would meet at wherever they could find a space, a church, or they met frequently at Georgetown University Chapel. And sometimes they would go to they do a visiting. They'd go. I remember one time we went to Anacostia. That's the black area of Southeast Washington, D.C. And extremely, extremely, extremely poor. And the kids, some of the kids, they had swollen bellies. Their arms were thin as they looked like kids that were starving. And we were pretty shocked to see that. Right. 10 miles from our house. That had a big impact on me as a kid. We just couldn't believe there's people that were starving right in our city. Yeah, that was a black church, and they brought a bunch of white liberals and their kids down to the front lines there. My parents were kind of They went to the anti-war demonstrations, and they took us with them, the big ones, like at the Washington Monument, and where famous musicians like Phil Oakes or Pete Seeger would sing. So there was an attractive kind of thing, but it was mostly speeches. And we marched on the Pentagon one time, from Washington, all the way from the Capitol to the Pentagon. That was a long walk, it was a rainy day, and we had a soldier's name who had been killed, a U.S. soldier who had been killed. I mean, a lot of the anti-war movement was because, tens of thousands of young men were being killed, and U.S. citizens, aside from the fact that a million Vietnamese were being killed, but the 50,000 United States soldiers were killed, people knew, everybody had no knew some, and the draft was a main irritant to the younger population. So the anti-draft movement and the anti-war movement kind of synonymous at that time.
You experienced a separation from the church pretty early
Well,
on as well.
what happened was, my parents started fooling around with other people, and they had affairs, or my father specifically had an affair with this woman that he fell in love with, and my parents got divorced eventually. Over Took them a couple of years. My mother
Right, and
ran
this
away.
was also during. I mean, this was the 60s, so there was
Summer of
maybe
Love.
love in the air,
Yeah,
right?
Summer of Love. My mother was philosophically supportive of free love, but my father's the one who he married the woman he had the affair with. She had five kids. He had six kids. So we ended up living out in the suburb, exurbs in rural Maryland, where KKK still had a very strong foothold, and in a big old dilapidated mansion that was owned by, it was pre-Civil War, it was owned by a slaveholder. It was his summer home.
So let's step into your budding adult life.
I moved to New York City, and I went to Columbia University in the fall of 1973, and I turned 17 first week of school. And I didn't realize that Columbia University, while it had women enrolled in the university, Columbia College, the undergraduate school, was actually all male. Anyway, that was a real shock, and the men at that school were pretty despicable, and I was in sort of a early stages of questioning gender and sexuality, and I was a very feminine teenager. I grew my hair long when I was 11, and then I never cut it, and so and I looked quite girlish, and I dressed in girlish clothes, and a lot of people on meeting me would take me for a girl. That was another reason why I wanted to get rid of the name Benedict. It didn't sound very girly.
Were you still concerned about being drafted in 1973?
Well, the draft was on. My brother was eligible to be drafted, but they had started a lottery at that time, and that they picked the numbers out of a bowl, and the number was the day of the year. And if your draft lottery number was one, you were going to Vietnam. But if your draft number was 300, then you probably weren't going. And he got something in the upper 200s, and so he never got drafted. But he was ready to move to Canada to evade the draft. And so I was worried about it. But the war was starting to be what they call Vietnamization, and the U.S. soldiers were withdrawing, and supposedly, the Vietnamese army was going to stand on their own and defeat
The
the
South
North
Vietnamese.
Vietnamese. Yeah, the South Vietnamese were going to defeat the North Vietnamese. But so I was ready to. I didn't register. I never registered for the draft. So technically, I broke the law. I think Carter pardoned me. So, they had stopped calling people up by the time I was 18.
By the time you got to Columbia, you had already stopped practicing Catholicism, right? Or how, what
That's a
was your
good.
relationship, I suppose,
Yeah,
to
that's a good
Catholicism?
question. You know, when my parents stopped going to Blessed Sacrament and started going to the hippie underground masses, we all just went with them, and it was strange. And I was a hippie kid, and then when they got divorced, the Roman Catholic Church doesn't permit divorce, and it's a sin to remarry. So they actually got a defrocked priest who was kicked out of the priesthood to do their wedding. My father's second wife. So in effect, they got kicked out of the church for getting divorced, and the anti-war church kind of fragmented quite a bit as the war wound down, and he was now living in suburban Maryland, and there were no anti-war activists in our neighborhood. But he stopped going to church, so we didn't. There was no way. There was no church I could get to. So when I got to college, it was kind of a moot point. I wasn't really thinking about it too much until I took LSD. My mother had taken LSD quite a few years before, and so and my brother had taken. It's sort of something, a rite of passage in a certain sense. And but I took it really seriously, and I had read the serious books about LSD and religion and spirituality. So I sort of programmed myself up to be ready to have a religious experience, as they say, when I took the acid. And lo and behold, I did. And
And when was this? And
what's
where
this?
was this?
It was at
Probably even
Columbia.
more
It was, oh yeah,
importantly.
well, we had the students. There was a thing called BNs back then. It was sort of like a protest to legalized marijuana, which was very illegal at the time, and but privileged college kids such as we
Well,
were,
it's illegal on a national level, I think.
yeah, and but it was illegal everywhere then, and it was a serious crime. You could get quite a bit of time in jail for it. However, college kids, and there are a lot of prep school rich kids at Columbia University, are privileged, and they can smoke pot, so it was widely prevalent, and we smoked lots of it. But we wanted to make a statement, so we had a BN where about 50 or 60 students got on the South Lawn, and where they did the current occupations, and smoked pot. And about 10 or 20 of us took acid. And so I started tripping. When the BN ended, I didn't know anybody. And I went over to St. John the Divine Church as a place to think about God. And it was very moving, but I didn't start going back to church right away, but I now had some direct experiences, spiritual experiences that made me. I had never really embraced atheism in any serious way because, but I was to set a phenomena that led me to believe in God again. And
So when you say a set of phenomenon, you mean
well, I took acid that one day, and then I eventually, I got into a position of I started an LSD co-op with some drug dealing friends, and we bought 50 tabs or something like this, and I bought 10 of them, and so I had a nice little stash of windowpane LSD, which is a very pure. Could take it, I took it about once a month for about a year, and I try to write about my experiences that I would have. I would have conversations with dead people. I would have conversations with saints, conversations with God, or a form of an element. It's God's too big. The burning bush phenomena is, you can't look God directly in its being because it's too overwhelming for human capacity. So there's that sense too of and the oneness of the universe, and then also satanic and evil. I got a had a very strong belief in evil, so I perceived a lot of things as evil.
you've just heard episode one of two of our interview with Jesse Clark. In our next installment, we follow up with Jesse about the 70s drug culture, the politics of gender sexuality, and Roman Catholicism's position on political violence. Bridging the Bones is an
independent podcast free of influence from Fortune 500 corporations, governments, and political parties. You can find more episodes on our website, bridgingthebones.fyi. Much thanks to Andres Rodriguez for the use of his musical theme, El Llamado. This is your host, Sidney Wang, signing off.